Welcome back to Audio Notes. I'm Dimitria Tappan.
And I'm Haeyeon Park. And we are eager to welcome you to the seventh and final program of the Music at Menlo 2025 season, Constellations Ensemble Magic, the program titled 6 to 8.
In David Finkel's words, offering one of the lushest textures of any instrumental combination, the string sextet has long been a favorite ensemble of both listeners and performers. However, it took the genius of Mendelssohn to conceive of history's most popular octet long before sextets blossomed in the Romantic era.
This program traces this rich evolution from Brahms's expensive sextet No. 1, full of warmth and depth, to Georg Widman's playful and energetic 180 beats per minute, a modern take inspired by techno rhythms and rhythmic wit.
And we end with one of the most astonishing achievements in chamber music history, Mendelssohn's Octet, composed at just 16, a brilliant and joyful work that set a new standard for string ensemble writing. So let us take a ride from 6 to 8 and discover these larger string ensembles unlocking new textures, colors, and expressive possibilities. Johannes Brahms's String Sextet No. 1 in B-flat major, Opus 18, is a cornerstone of the chamber music repertoire, composed between 1859 and 1860 when Brahms was still in his late 20s. At this point, he was forging his compositional voice, working under the shadow of Beethoven's immense legacy and under the guidance and inspiration of his close friend, Clara Schumann. Brahms approached this work with a sense of reverence for tradition. Much like his reluctance to enter the symphonic realm until later in his career, Brahms was also cautious when it came to the string quartet, a genre dominated by the works of Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven. Instead, Brahms expanded the ensemble to include two violins, two violas, and two cellos, crafting a sextet that allowed for a richer, more complex sound world. The addition of a second viola and cello opened up possibilities for deeper sonorities and more intricate thematic interplay. Interestingly, although Luigi Boccherini had written early examples of the string sextet in the 1770s, the genre had remained relatively untouched until Brahms revitalized it. His sextet in B-flat reawakened interest in this configuration, inspiring Brahms himself to write years later his second string sextet in G major, and later composers such as Dvořák, Tchaikovsky, and Schoenberg to explore the format in their own works. Here is the violist Masumi Per-Rostad with his thoughts on being immersed into the texture of a Brahms sextet, particularly from the middle seat of the viola.
So one of Brahms's great gifts as a composer is his construction and the way he brings all the various elements of harmony and rhythm and structure all together. And as a violist, you have an inside view. You foreshadow harmonically and sometimes even rhythmically what's about to change and develop in his music. And so not only one viola, but having two violas on the inside with the added padding of an additional cellist, it makes the adventure all that more interesting and in a way revealing from the inside. You can hear so much.
And indeed, as we venture into the piece, there is so much to listen for. The first movement, marked Allegro ma non troppo, begins with a warm and flowing theme introduced by the first cello, a lyrical and song-like melody that sets the introspective tone for the entire work. Brahms chooses to open with restraint and spaciousness, eschewing the dramatic, assertive introductions common in romantic chamber music. The second theme emerges, playful and waltz-like, first stated by the first cello, then echoed by the violin and viola, climbing higher and higher before being interrupted by an unexpected chord. As the development unfolds, sighing motives pass between the violin, viola, and cello, building to an intense climax filled with triplet rhythms, repeated notes, and the full force of all six instruments. The recapitulation reintegrates the initial themes, but this time the opening melody is no longer entrusted solely to the first cello. Now it is shared by the violins and viola, played with heightened intensity and syncopated rhythm. The second theme returns, now given to the viola in the recapitulation, offering a different color and perspective. Here is violist Masumi Perrostad again with his thoughts on this moment.
There's an incredible moment in the first movement where a viola gets the tune and plays the most noble and optimistic and reaching melody. It's just an incredible line where you just ascend into the higher registers of the viola, you know, and just sing across this sea of strings around you.
As the turbulent sea of strings settles, Brahms marks the ending poco più moderato. Here the instruments play pizzicato, creating a delicate and unusual texture. Distant droplets of rain, the reflections of the sun playing on water. A magical, bittersweet, almost nostalgic conclusion. The second movement, Andante ma moderato, is one of Brahms's most hauntingly introspective works. Cast in D minor, the movement unfolds as a theme and variations, evoking a solemn, almost funeral march quality. The noble melancholic theme is introduced by the first viola, and here, with a description, is once again Masumi Perrostad.
The opening theme of this slow movement is a statement of defiance. You know, you have this heaviness around you. You feel a response from the accompanimental, bah, bah, you know, this responding rhythmic figure, and you slowly ascend in pitch, and you feel the resistance through suspended rhythmic values, through ties, you know, the reaching past beats. It's almost kind of like you're gritting your teeth, but you're reaching. You're still trying to get to this point of optimism, maybe.
Let us listen. The first three variations introduce increasingly intricate rhythmic patterns and create the illusion of accelerating motion. The fourth variation shifts to the major mode, offering a warm and expressive respite. Then the fifth variation begins with a hushed, ethereal quality. Both cellos drop out entirely, while the first viola carries a delicate melody above a high-pitched accompaniment from the violins and a droning figure in the second viola, evoking the sound of bagpipes. In the coda, the original theme returns in its somber D minor form, played once again by the first cello. Light accompaniment lends a nostalgic, wistful air to the conclusion of this deeply emotional movement, a movement that was particularly beloved by Clara Schumann, to whom Brahms presented a piano transcription for her 41st birthday. Did you notice it? Did you hear Brahms's amazing magic trick? The movement doesn't end in the somber minor, but in the placid major, foreshadowing the turn to optimism of the third movement, a scherzo in F major, which bursts forth with playful energy and lively themes. So dancey and bouncy and full of graceful character. Now the middle section, the trio, remains in F major but introduces a set of animated rustic elements. A true village party, isn't it? And how interesting that this raucous mood precedes the finale, marked rondo, poco allegretto, e grazioso. Graceful and charming, these are the characters that Brahms chooses for the conclusion of his first sextet. The finale opens with an expansive sunlit theme, which is once again introduced by the first cello. Contrasting, powerful middle section calls to mind procedures of canonic imitation that harken back to Bach and were championed by Mozart in his symphonic writing. Dramatic contrapuntal calls and responses dominate this area. As the movement progresses, Brahms demonstrates his mastery of instrumental interplay. Sometimes all six instruments are engaged in a lively dialogue, while at other moments, smaller groups of three or four engage in witty exchanges. Brahms is clearly having fun with these musical conversations, yet beneath the playful exterior lies meticulous compositional control of the highest order. Just before the coda, Brahms deconstructs the theme entirely, reducing it to sighing gestures that pass between the instruments before the first cello reintroduces the melody one final time. Closing moments, the accumulated energy of all six players dissipates into gentle pizzicati, answered by delicate gestures from the violins, bringing the excitement to a calm pause. But Brahms doesn't let the mood linger. He propels the ensemble into a spectacular coda marked animato poco a poco più, animated and little by little evermore, culminating in a triumphant and resounding conclusion. The String Sextet No. 1 was premiered in Hanover in October 1860, led by none other than Brahms's friend and renowned violinist Josef Joachim. Since then, it has remained a beloved staple of the chamber music repertoire, captivating audiences and musicians alike with its warmth, lyricism, and brilliance.
York Bittman is one of the most exciting voices in contemporary classical music. Born in Germany in 1973, Bittman is not only a renowned composer, but also a virtuoso clarinetist and an accomplished conductor. He began his studies in Munich at the Hochschule für Musik and later continued at the Juilliard School in New York. Over the years, Bittman has made a name for himself with a style that brilliantly balances tradition and innovation. His music often pays homage to classical forms while fearlessly exploring new sonic territory. Bittman's compositions range from intimate chamber pieces to full-scale orchestral works and operas. As a composer, he's been featured as artist in residence at prestigious institutions like the Salzburg Festival, the Lucerne Festival, the Vienna Concert House, and with the Cleveland Orchestra, just to name a few. His music has been commissioned by leading ensembles around the world, including the Boston Symphony Orchestra and the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. Regarding the work to be presented on Music at Menlo stage, here is what the composer had to say in his own words about 180 beats per minute, and I quote, 180 beats per minute was composed in 1993, shortly after I had left school. My inspiration for this piece was the then highly popular fast techno beats. A rhythmic drive and permanent change of pulse whizzes past at maximum speed, which is 180 beats per minute. The structure becomes condensed into a study on one single chord, which in principle is varied throughout the entire piece, while remaining constant from the aspect of its tonal material. Ultimately, the music fuses into a six-voice canon, wandering through all instruments from the first violin to the third cello and oscillating between the major and minor third. The work makes no claims to be more than the sum of its parts, the sheer enjoyment of rhythm, end quote. The work can be performed in two different instrumentations, either with two violins, two violas, and two cellos, which is a more traditional string sextet makeup, reminiscent of Brahms, or with two violins, one viola, and three cellos, a clever instrumentation more appropriate to the voicing required. At just over 5 minutes long, it's an exhilarating race to the end. The piece opens with a rhythmic pulsating texture in the low voices, boiling with energy and expectation. Soon, a kind of fiddling melody emerges in the higher voices. It's bright, nimble, and unmistakably folk-like, evoking the spirit of Eastern European musical traditions. This folk-inspired energy runs through the entire piece, gradually building in intensity. In the middle section, each instrument introduces a folk-like tune. It's actually a canon, a musical form where each voice enters in turn with the same melody. It is a phenomenal way to build tension through the ensemble. After the return of the opening material, a fast-paced coda brings the work to a satisfying finish. Wiedemann's music is a perfect example of how the tradition of a string sextet is alive and well in the hands of contemporary masters.
As music at Menlo's season comes to a close, there's no better way to celebrate than with one of the most jubilant works in chamber music repertoire, Felix Mendelssohn's Octet in E-flat major, opus 20. Written in 1825, when Mendelssohn was just 16 years old, the octet is widely regarded as one of the most astonishingly precocious compositions in Western music. Not even Mozart or Schubert produced works of this depth and sophistication at such a young age. Mendelssohn came from a culturally rich background, growing up in a household filled with intellectual and artistic influences. Young Felix, as well as his beloved sister Fanny, showed extraordinary talent from an early age. By the time he composed the octet, he had already written 12 string symphonies and several chamber works, but it was this piece that marked a turning point in his career, signaling the emergence of his mature style. And what's even more remarkable, Mendelssohn didn't just compose a phenomenal piece, he basically invented a new genre. Before Mendelssohn, the idea of a string octet didn't really exist in the form we know today. That's not to say there weren't other pieces for eight string instruments. Composers like Louis Spohr and George Onslow had written works for double quartets. However, these earlier pieces treated the ensembles more independently, often pitting one quartet against the other, creating an almost conversational dynamic between two quartets. Mendelssohn took a different approach. Instead of treating the octet as two string quartets placed side by side, he fused all eight instruments into a single dynamic ensemble. The result was a rich orchestral texture where the instruments interact seamlessly, creating layers of complexity and color. This innovation gave the octet a symphonic dimension, making it feel far larger than a typical chamber work. Mendelssohn's approach opens up an extraordinary range of possibilities for the ensemble. At times, the music takes on the grandeur of a symphony. At others, it echoes the brilliance of a violin concerto. Flitting moments of duo and trio textures are seamlessly juxtaposed with powerful full ensemble climaxes, creating a sonic tapestry that is rich, dynamic, and deeply engaging for both the performers and listeners. His large-scale intentions are unmistakable in the score, where he emphasizes, and I quote, "The octet must be played by all the instruments in symphonic orchestral style. Pianos and fortes must be strictly observed and more strongly emphasized than is usual in pieces of this character." For additional insight into this remarkable work, here is violist Masumi Per Rostad sharing his thoughts on the Mendelssohn octet.
It's my view, and I don't think I'm alone in this, that Mendelssohn was the absolute best string writer of all time. He is the one who captured the essence of what string sound is, what a string instrument can do. He understood it really from the inside out, texturally, sonically. And the string octet is arguably one of the best pieces ever written. It's an absolute masterpiece. He was just a teenager when he wrote it, which puts us all to shame. But that's okay, because Mendelssohn was, I think, the greatest musical prodigy of all time. He outshone even Mozart. Mozart was not writing as a teenager what Mendelssohn was writing. But Mendelssohn had a very rigorous childhood. He would get up at, you know, at the crack of dawn or pre-dawn every day, and had many hours of bespoke tutoring. Both he and his sister Fanny, where they would learn philosophy, music, you know, theory, history, and they just had an incredible kind of curated childhood. And so it's no wonder that by the time he was a teenager, he was able to write this incredible music.
And here is Benjamin Beilman with his view of what this music feels like from the leading seat of the first violin.
If you are skeptical or unsure about classical music, the only piece that I would recommend that could possibly persuade you to love classical music would be Mendelssohn's String Octet. He wrote this work when he was 16 years old, if you can imagine that. And it is the greatest exploration of what's possible in chamber music, in an ensemble for each individual instrument, and also just in a kind of chorus of voices. It's majestic, it's triumphant, and it was written by a child prodigy. I mean, like, what more can you ask for? The piece is constructed with 8 equal voices, led in narration from the first violin chair, a great kind of interweaving of various voices. How do 2 cellos play together? How do 2 violas play together? How do 2 string quartets play together? It's chamber music at its finest.
Chamber music at its finest indeed. The showmanship and confidence of the young genius are unmistakable, not only in the music itself, but also in the gesture that followed its creation. Upon completing the score, Mendelssohn signed it and presented it as a birthday gift to his violin teacher, Eduard Rietz. More than a mentor, Rietz was a lifelong friend whose virtuosity inspired the dazzling, almost concerto-like writing for the first violin. So impressed was Rietz by his pupil's work that he immediately copied out the parts in preparation for the premiere. Let us turn our attention then to the work itself. The octet opens with a glorious first movement marked Allegro Moderato, ma con fuoco, moderately fast, but with fire. The first violin soars with an ascending arpeggiated theme, which is swiftly echoed and developed by the ensemble. The intention is clear: to dazzle, to impress, and to announce a bold new voice in music. The second theme, introduced in the dominant key of B-flat major, offers a lyrical contrast but maintains the rhythmic vitality of the opening. Mendelssohn's mastery of texture becomes especially apparent in the development, where he uses imitation, counterpoint, and fragmentation to let different subgroups of the ensemble trade phrases and engage in rhythmic interplay. ¶¶ As we approach the recapitulation, one remarkable moment demands attention. Over a syncopated pedal point in the cellos, the momentum begins to surge. More and more voices join in with joyful, cascading scales that ascend and descend in gleeful abandon. The entire ensemble races towards the resolution in unison, driven by a flurry of 16th notes. It's an exhilarating moment, a whirlwind of energy that reveals the almost unreasonably daring imagination of the young genius. Mendelssohn, only 16 at the time, doesn't just show mastery, he shows fearlessness. After this spectacular resolution, the recapitulation reaffirms the radiant dominance of E-flat major, propelling the work towards an exhilarating coda. In the closing bars of the movement, the two cellos drive forward with relentless eighth note motion, gradually joined by the rest of the ensemble in a jubilant crescendo. As the first violin makes an assertive arrival, one can almost imagine it declaring in German, "Ich liebe dich," I love you all, before the final triumphant chords bring the movement to a close. The second movement, Andante, ushers in a mood that is deeply lyrical and introspective. Set in C minor, the relative minor of the home key, it opens with a striking gesture. The two violas sustain open G and C strings, evoking a stark, almost medieval atmosphere. This is immediately followed by a poignant, sighing theme in the first cello, laden with a sense of longing and regret. Then, as if offering reconciliation, the first violin enters with the same melody, now gently supported by harmonies in the major mode, soothing, tender, and full of quiet consolation. Here is violist Masumi Perostad describing this movement.
The second movement is incredible. There are just so many elements to it that make it one of the most beautiful things ever written. It starts out with the opening fifths with the viola, which almost recalls ancient music. And with this kind of swinging 6/8 meter, you have both a focus on the eighth note, but also on a large two and also large relationships between the bar lines. And on another level, you also feel this incredible celestial movement where you have these cascading scales that are passed from groups of instruments to other groups of instruments. But you also feel the pain between each of these intervals.
Indeed. As we will hear in a moment, the music here captivates with its cascading chains of thirds, ethereal and magical, as if tears were gently falling from heaven. There is a sense of innocent yearning woven through the texture, expressed in the delicate interplay of lines and the lingering beauty of suspensions. It's a moment of haunting fragility where sorrow and sweetness coexist in perfect balance. A dramatic double-dotted outburst follows. Soon thereafter, the movement draws to a close with a remarkable moment of emotional clarity. As the texture shifts from the hopeful major back to the somber minor, the viola's relentless 16th note motion becomes an almost prayerful inner monologue. Sighing semitones trace a line of quiet pleading, begging and questioning, and ultimately finding rest in the stillness of the final two chords. The third movement is another incredible composition, unique in its invention and perhaps most Mendelssohnian in character. It is a scherzo marked Allegro Leggerissimo, Allegro as light as possible. This whimsical miniature, lasting under 5 minutes, was inspired, according to Felix's sister Fanny, by the closing lines of the Walpurgis Night's Dream from Goethe's Faust, and I quote, "Trails of cloud and mist brighten from above, breeze in the trees and wind in the reeds, and all is scattered." End quote. Mendelssohn was a devoted admirer of Goethe, and he had met the poet just a few years earlier during a family trip to Weimar. Their meeting left a profound impression on Mendelssohn, and this connection with Goethe's work found its way into the scherzo of the octet. What's incredible is that when you look at the manuscript, you'll find no revisions or corrections. Mendelssohn's vision for this movement was crystal clear from the start. Here is Masumi Perostat offering his thoughts.
I had an experience when I was in college at Juilliard. I took a class called the Study of Manuscripts, and we went down to the Morgan Library, and we saw manuscripts in the hand of Mendelssohn. And it was incredible because, like Mozart, he didn't make mistakes. And when he did, which was very rare, both of them, they would just do a very little mark and just cross it out. Okay, that happened. Let's move on. Whereas, you know, you see something by Beethoven and it's like, he's going to scratch it out so much that there's a hole in the page, you know, and it's like illegible. But there's a kind of a perfection to the way it spilled out of Mendelssohn's head.
And here is violinist Benjamin Beilman with his thoughts on the ethereal qualities of this movement.
The third movement is, even as a 16-year-old, a perfect representation of what Mendelssohn is most known for, which is his light, agile, nimble, Midsummer Night Dream, fairy dust music. He keeps us all pianissimo. We're supposed to be as fleet as possible. And as one would expect of Mendelssohn, he does not make it easy, technically. We have to climb to the top register of the violin or the lowest point of the cello, and all of it has to be done dancing on our tiptoes. It should feel like the gentlest breeze has just passed through your hair.
Let us take a listen. Thank you. Critic Harold Schoenberg famously described this movement as a miracle of graceful, tripping, light-as-air writing. Instead of using the traditional scherzo-trio-scherzo format, Mendelssohn opted for a miniature sonata form with a development section that features one of the most complex interplays yet between the instruments. The word tiptoeing comes to mind again and again when listening to this wistful, fairy tale-like movement. Mendelssohn conjures a world of fleeting shadows and delicate mischief, where the music dances lightly on the edge of silence. The movement concludes with the entire ensemble playing in unison, a hushed eighth note passage that seems to vanish into the night wind like a dream dissolving at dawn. The final movement, Presto, is one of the most brilliant in the chamber music repertoire. Mendelssohn launches into a rapid fugue subject, beginning with the second cello and ascending through all eight instruments to create a densely woven contrapuntal fabric. Let's take a listen to this opening and pay attention to the fast-paced eighth notes of the initial runs and then the culminating angular motif in the high register of the violin. The influence of Bach as the master of the counterpoint and fugue, whom Mendelssohn deeply admired, is unmistakable. Here is Masumi Perostad.
When Mendelssohn was a teenager, he mounted a performance of Bach's St. Matthew Passion, which brought to the attention the music of Johann Sebastian Bach. The world had forgotten Bach, and Mendelssohn said, "This is too incredible to be forgotten." And in mounting this performance, we now are able to enjoy Bach's music. And I think that had a profound impact on Mendelssohn as a composer. He often introduces fugues into his writing. I think of that as a direct nod to Bach. The opening of the last movement of this octet begins with a fugue, and he does this incredibly. He starts with the lowest of the cellos and slowly works his way through the entire ensemble. And at the end, you land on the first violin, and it slowly builds this kind of excitement and bristling energy. And there's so much of that in this movement. It's heroic, it's triumphant, it's exciting. And I think the musicians want to jump to their feet at the end of this performance.
And now let's hear from Benjamin Beilman.
The last movement is the most fun to play, I think, across the entire ensemble. There's a sense that everybody is sort of feeding the gasoline into the engine of this work. It starts in the lowest register with the second cello stating the theme of what's about to happen, this fugue idea. Fugues are essentially the highest art form, the highest intellectual exercise that a composer can present. And very often fugues can be dull. But in Mendelssohn's case, at 16 years old, he makes it perhaps the most joyous piece of music ever created.
So, we know there is a great influence of Johann Sebastian Bach woven into this finale. But remember that angular motif in the high register of the violins? That's something else entirely. It introduces another subject, one that will soon join the first in what becomes a double fugue. And here's where Mendelssohn's brilliance really shines. This is also a clever double homage, in this case, to another giant of the Baroque, George Friedrich Händel. The theme is a direct quote from the Messiah, specifically the line, "And he shall reign forever and ever." Listen again. Do you hear it? Mendelssohn isn't just referencing his predecessors, he's celebrating them, weaving their legacy into his own youthful voice with remarkable skill and affection. Throughout the movement, the intensity never wanes, driving rhythms, virtuosic passages, and ever-increasing textural density propel the music with unstoppable momentum. And as the finale races towards its conclusion, Mendelssohn weaves in yet another layer of sophistication by recalling the scherzo near the end, a clear embrace of what is known as cyclical form. This technique, likely gleaned from his study of Mozart's Jupiter Symphony and Beethoven's Fifth, ties the entire work together before building up to the final coda. Now, when it comes to the actual coda, it is fittingly expansive and electrifying. The syncopated B-flat pedal in the cellos returns, remember the first movement? And it creates mounting tension beneath increasingly animated textures. This sustained buildup eventually erupts into a triumphant resolution, bringing the octet to a close with a breathtaking sense of coherence, energy, and mastery. Mendelssohn's octet is truly a miracle of youthful genius, technically dazzling, emotionally rich, and structurally brilliant. It marked the beginning of his mature style and foreshadowed the extraordinary works that would follow. Whether you are hearing it for the first time or the 50th, it never fails to amaze with its freshness, invention, and pure joy. It's no wonder that this work is the perfect way to conclude our festival. This concludes our discussion of Concert Program 7, 6 to 8. A special thank you to Amy Cota for her immense help in procuring the audio samples, to the organizations who provided access to their catalogs, and to the artists who agreed to share their thoughts on the music. I'm Dimitri Atapin.
And I'm Hayam Park. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you at the concerts very soon.
Audio notes are written and produced by Dimitri Atapin and Hayan Park in consultation with David Finkel in Wuhan. Many thanks to Benjamin Beilman and Masumi Per-Rostad for speaking with us for this session. Audio excerpts are courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Brahms Sextet No. 1 in B-flat Major, Opus 18, performed by Sean Lee and Alexander Sitkovetsky violins, Matthew Lipman and Richard O'Neill violas, as well as Keith Robinson and David Finkel cellos, courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Widmann 180 beats per minute, performed by the members of the WDR Symphony Orchestra Cologne, courtesy of the WDR Symphony Orchestra Cologne. Mendelssohn Octet for Strings Opus 20, performed by members of the Emerson and the Calidore String Quartets, Eugene Drucker, Philip Setzer, Jeffrey Myers and Ryan Meehan violins, Lawrence Dutton and Jeremy Berry violas, as well as Paul Watkins and Estelle Choi cellos, courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.